Welcome to the Emmy Louie Show. I'm Emmy Louie, and today's topic is about daylighting and lighting with Victor Olgay. He's the principal of the Rocky Mountain Institute Built Environment Team. Mr. Olgay has a wide variety of experiences in architectural design, planning, laboratory design and integration, environmental and acoustical systems, with specialization in lighting and daylighting design. While spending 8 years as an associate professor of architecture at the University of Hawaii, Mr. Olgay was named director of research with various lighting and daylighting research projects for federal and state agencies. Mr. Olgay's breadth in lighting and daylighting design ranges from small private residences to large university campuses. Welcome, Victor.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Thank you for being on my show. Daylighting is an amazing topic, isn't it?
Well, I find it to be a pretty seminal topic. I was very lucky early on in my career to work with a fellow named Bill Lamb, who taught me that daylighting is really one of your sort of primary human experiences. You know, as a person negotiating your way through the world, we constantly are bumping into different sorts of visual information, and we respond to that. And so that ends up being kind of the way we end up relating to the world, through positive and negative stimuli and making sense out of this all of this visual information. And if you organize that through good lighting and daylighting, then you can actually have a better experience, a better human experience. And so it turns out that daylighting and electric lighting is really primary to our understanding of the world, and luckily it also ends up being kind of the thin end of a wedge that allows us to get energy efficiency into our contemporary buildings.
I think it's really exciting that we live by light, and we understand form through light, and maybe many of us are not really aware of that day to day, because we just go about our business, just living, but all of these things that people take for granted, just even being able to read at night, or just living out their lives and looking at color and all that. And here you are, you're studying it. So I think it's exciting that you're in this field. You're right in the middle of what you're excited about.
Well, it certainly is a great thing. I always feel quite blessed that I've managed to follow my interests, and my interests have managed to be lucrative enough to allow me to pursue them and make a living. So I think that's actually kind of a primary thing for a lot of people, is to be able to have enough faith in the things that they're interested in to pursue them and follow their hearts, and oftentimes that ends up being a really great thing.
I know.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I know this is not in my questions that I sent to you, but you're related to another Victor Olgay, right? Is that your father?
That's correct.
Can you tell me a little about your father's legacy? or a little or a lot?
Oh, sure. As much as you'd like. my father was an identical twin, and grew up in Budapest, Hungary. And my grandfather, his father, was an artist of kind of a well-known artist in Hungary around the turn of the century. And the arts clearly influenced my father and my uncle, Victor and Oladar. And as they grew up in Budapest, they went to the university and became architects. And they did something which was actually not unusual for architects. At the time, the young, enthusiastic guys would enter lots of competitions, and they were actually able to win quite a few of those and get lots of projects built quite quickly as youth. So they were sort of like they're sort of a phenomena in Hungary. They really were able to get a lot of projects done and do some very interesting work at a time when architecture was really quite an interesting field. They then emigrated after World War II to the United States, and They taught in several universities. They taught at Notre Dame and at MIT, and finally settled in Princeton, New Jersey, where they, in addition to having a teaching position at Princeton University, they conducted research, and they had private practices as well, doing mostly residential work, whereas in Hungary they had done a lot of institutional work, some really large buildings, chocolate factories, apartment complexes, many of which still exist over there, which is kind of fun to go see, you know, 50 years later. But the work that they're really best known for is bioclimatic architecture. So there was a book that Victor and Oladar did called Design with Climate, which was in print for, about 30 years or so, and went through several editions. And the idea behind Design with Climate is that we're integrating several different disciplines, that of climatology, that of sort of psychrometrics and kind of climate issue, human behavior issues, and architecture. So all of these things, the sort of engineering of architecture, the design, the context, are all now woven together into a way of approaching the field, which is interdisciplinary and integrative.
I know, I read that book when I was in school, 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that name was, they were teaching at, that person was teaching at University of Hawaii, which is you. And I thought, oh my God, this author is teaching at this school. And so I contacted you and realized, wow, you're the son of Victor Olvey. That is really neat.
It has been really neat. My father died on Earth Day in 1970. So I was just a 12-year-old, brat at that point. And I really had very little inkling of what his work was all about, and I was able to discover that on my own. But now that I've ended up pretty much in a similar field to what my father did and my uncle did, and I'm an architect and I work in bioclimatic design and daylighting and so forth, I meet a lot of people that either had my father as a professor or know of his work, and they're always sort of mistaking me for him, like, I thought you were two older men or something like this. It's a... It's a great legacy to have.
Well, good for you. I guess it's, for the most part, it's a good thing to have that name.
Well, it's a hard one to mistake. There's not a lot of us out there.
Am I pronouncing it correct?
Well, for better or worse, it's Hungarian, and because of that, it's virtually impossible to actually pronounce or spell correctly. But it's the GY is sort of a J sound, so it's an old Jai.
Oh, okay.
Olgay is pretty commonly used.
Okay. Okay, so I know daylighting is in the green architecture industry, it's a very talked about subject. And I wanted you to kind of give us an update to us lay people as well as the people, the green building professionals, about the LEED programs and the issues with the daylighting from what you're doing versus what the leadership and energy,
environmental design.
And could you tell me any differences or similarities on those kind of what the stands are and what the Rocky Mountain Institute says as well as what the LEED says?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess there's not so much controversy as there is kind of an evolution of the field. Daylighting is, on one hand, a very simple idea that basically you're letting, natural light into the building and displacing the use of electric lights. So right now I'm sitting in my office and I have no electric lights on because it's a beautiful day outside and I've got some windows to the outside. So that's not terribly complicated. But as a field...
It has to be complicated because this is your full-time job. So what is going on with that?
Well, so it goes from the very, as you can imagine, the very simple sorts of things that you do at a residential scale or at a simple office near a window kind of idea to things that are really quite complicated. And then it becomes an issue of mostly integrating it with the other architectural systems. And so at its best, daylighting is a design issue, just like any other part of the built environment that we deal with on a daily basis. And that's really, I think, where the art and science come into it. And so we can go from a very straightforward idea of, daylighting basically is provides you with the ability to do what you want to do, gives you the visual information you need in order to read a book, to work at your computer, to negotiate through space. But at a much more rarefied level, what we're doing is we're predicting the amount of light that's in a space that's unbuilt, either using computerized technology or physical models or other kinds of predictive methods, to understand how we can distribute that light in the space so that we have, appropriate amounts and acceptable quality of light in the different areas of a building. And then also we want to balance it with the amount of heat gain that comes with the light, because the light is not simply the visual spectrum, but it also has ultraviolet and infrared spectrums, and that can be a benefit or a hindrance depending on what you're trying to do. So in a house, a passive solar house, you would oftentimes like to have heat gain in the wintertime through south-facing windows and then be able to shade it in the summertime so that you're not getting direct sunlight in the times when you'd actually, have too much heat, where you'd have a cooling load. So that basic idea tells you that you want to balance the amount of light with the amount of heat gain and the time of year that you have heat gain and the exterior temperatures, and all those things kind of fold together into a kind of a beautiful tapestry of how you want to kind of make the building respond to all of those different environmental influences.
Okay, so hopefully we're not losing our layperson audience here as far as what you're talking about. Let's take a little break. We are here with Victor Ogjay, and I'm Emmy Louie. We'll be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and we're back with Victor Ogjay from the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's a principal there, and he's part of the built environment team. We're talking about daylighting, and let's start with something very simple with just windows and orientation of the buildings. For example, the office that you're in, is it north facing? I know that there's a huge issue, I think, with computers because of the glare. And I think the most optimal location, there's a certain optimal location for the orientation of a window with where the computer is.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on that?
Sure.
You want to expound on it?
You're touching on a couple of different topics.
I usually do that.
This office. orientation,
but usually it is complex. It is kind of complex because once you put in, there's a lot of things that you have to negotiate with when you have
Absolutely.
A computer.
Yeah, and we can break it down into sub-issues, and hopefully that'll kind of make sense. I think that there is an optimal orientation for buildings and for daylighting. And a lot of that has to do, again, with sort of the bioclimatic side of it. How does the building fit into the environment? If you're trying to, if your building is a small house, building like a house where it's got issues of wanting to be, warm in a cool climate in the winter, then south-facing windows can be great. Now, of course, with that south-facing window comes direct light, and it can be really bright, so you need to shade and redirect that light so you're not getting glare or other kind of things that are going to interfere with your ability to do your work. So traditionally in buildings, when people talked about, a painter's studio or daylighting for, art, they always said, these north-facing windows in the attics of, buildings in France were the ideal thing, where you, basically had no possibility of direct sunlight coming in, and you'd have a very steady, cool light. And that is really nice. of course, that can be a problem as well. Sometimes you don't get enough light from a north side of a building. And, of course, if you have a building which has heating needs, then you could always benefit from getting light from the south with its heat content. You just need to be careful to control glare, no matter what orientation you have. In the building that we're in right now, the Rocky Mountain Institute's Boulder office, is an existing building. So we renovated this building, and it has a little bit of glass on the north and south, but the main facade faces west, which is really about the worst thing you can do for daylighting.
I know.
Or for heat gain in general.
Yeah.
But it was an existing building, and what it did have going for it was a fairly narrow floor plate. It's only about 40 feet deep, so we're able to have windows on two sides of that long building and get a nice distribution of daylight across it. We have different kinds of blinds that we can adjust to prevent glare at the window and still allow daylight to come in. And then in places where we were not able to get daylight into the middle of the space, we put skylights in, which were, again, tilted towards the south, but let daylight to come in, and we have a baffle underneath that to prevent glare and to distribute that light in the space. So even if you have a orientation that's less than optimal, we can oftentimes do the appropriate kind of controls to be able to utilize that daylight in a way that you know, doesn't allow too much heat gain in and prevents glare and so forth. Now, the issue with the computer is that usually the computer screen is actually emitting light, right? The computer, even if you have a little laptop, it's something which is internally illuminated. So you could most of the time actually work in the dark, and it's not a problem. It's really having too much light that's the problem. And in addition to that, the other thing that's the two things that are really bad about a computer is that it's usually the screen is vertical as opposed to a paper or a desktop sort of thing, which is horizontal. So your task is more vertical. And then also the screen itself is shiny or glossy or what we call specular, right? So it actually reflects things in the screen. And if you are facing a window, for example, and your screen is facing you, then you can oftentimes see your own reflection in your computer screen.
I thought that's just called glare. You made it sound very scientific. It sounds, you said specular. Isn't that glare?
Well, it's anything that interferes with your ability to see something is kind of is exactly that. It can be glare. It can be visual noise. It can be some kind of distracting reflections. So you can have things which are direct glare, like the sun that comes in directly into your eyes, or you can have reflected glare that's reflecting off a surface, like your computer screen. And so we need to account for all of those things. And luckily, the thing about light is that it follows pretty straightforward geometric rules, and so you can almost draw the direction of the light and predict a lot of times if you've got a really bright surface that you're going to be able to see in your computer screen in the mirror angle, then that'll cause some visual interference with what you're trying to do.
Yes, so we were talking about the computer. Did you finish that thought about the glare from the computer?
Yeah, so the simple answer actually for a computer screen is try and have them go perpendicular to the primary source of light in the window, so that way the light coming in the window isn't bouncing off the computer screen and back at you, but it's going maybe bouncing off the computer screen and going deeper into the space or somewhere else, so you don't get that glare reflecting back at you.
Yeah, I'm trying to visualize that. The thing is that, for example, So are you saying that the window can be behind the computer? Like, if you're facing the computer, can you have a window behind you?
Ideally, it's perpendicular to the screen. So if you're looking at your computer, the window is either to the left or the right of you. It shouldn't be behind you or in front of you.
Yeah.
Either of those things
can
cause more problems.
Okay, so if you're looking at the screen, listeners, the light source or the window should be on the left or the right of the screen.
Yes. That's typically the easiest way to deal with that issue.
What about if it's a window that like a transom, like a above. That there are ways where you can use there's a specific reason why you would use something that's overhead is because you want more wall space. Is when you don't.
Sure.
That's the reason why you don't want windows necessarily, especially in an office, because. And I think this is a huge misconception on even regular people, or maybe even you and me, is where we say, oh, we want things to be open. We want to be able to see out and have a great view. But what happens is that you lose wall space. And that means that you're not going to have that space that is where the window is going to be. You won't be able to put a bookshelf.
Right.
And you won't be able to put your pictures. So it's a real balance between wall space and windows.
And I think you're hitting on what I would kind of say is the seminal issue with daylighting and design in general, which is that you have to integrate all of these different influences. You have to balance the need for wall space with the need for views. You have to balance heat gain with, you know, the need for, you know, cooling and so forth and natural light. And when you integrate all those issues together and you synthesize it really well, I mean, it's beautiful. It's art. And so that's
why architects play in the game as far as the location of windows are concerned. But let's go back to that. What is that word? Oh, God, I forgot. It's not transom, because that's usually for an interior. Well, transom specifically are usually a window above
perhaps
a door.
Clear story?
A clear story, yes. Thank you for telling me that word. It's such a simple, well, not a simple word, but for architects it's a simple word. A clearer story, yes. So what is a great example of when you would use a clearer story? And I would say it would be something for a computer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what is the most optimal thing? If you wanted to put you wanted to have like a nice, office, and you wanted lighting, and you used a clear story. Where would that clear story, wouldn't that go facing north, so you don't get the direct light, right? I know. I'm sorry. This is like a quick question here, or something.
Yeah, and of course the
I'm
real.
I'm putting you on the spot.
The best answer is it depends. we could do it in any orientation, and each orientation gives its best kind of, it has its attributes. So
I'm so sorry, but you know what? What you just said is true. It really depends, and it's a really amazing. I was talking to I'm sorry I just interrupted you, but
okay.
I was talking with my girlfriend about this, and that we were saying, and of course, you were in Hawaii, and I grew up in Hawaii, and you know, we're on the mainland, and that lighting is very different around the world, natural lighting.
Yep.
And now that fall is hitting, the light is it's so different. And can you actually tell me, and I know we're going to talk about kind of generic stories, but can you tell me the same clear story window, how it would be in Hawaii versus Colorado? Could you tell me that? I mean, have you ever observed that?
Yeah.
Does that make any sense? I know I just jumped into something very specific.
That's okay. It's great. And it does very much fall into sort of the art of daylighting, because we can sit here and calculate, you know, that this place has so much cloud cover and, you know, there's so much, such a quantity of light available here or there. But we all know when we go to the beach and we're on the seashore, we have a different quality of light than at the same time of day with the same weather conditions, you know, in a forest or inland in some pasture, because it feels different. The light is different. The amount of moisture in the air is different. The scattering of the light, there's a quality to light which we don't know how to measure, which makes it feel different in different places. There's a genius of place which allows us to really take advantage of that sensibility that actually gets built and incorporated into sort of a vernacular architecture. So if we look at, for example, a clear story in Hawaii as opposed to a clear story in North Carolina, in Hawaii there's not a big tradition of clear story type of windows. Really what we see in Hawaii is typically those overhanging roofs with kind of large amounts of shade that is brought, sort of dicky roof or those kinds of things, which have there's a predominance actually of ground reflected light. So the tradition in the pilihale kind of thing in Hawaii is of small amounts of light, because there's so much light.
Mm-hmm.
It's small windows, and it's mostly light that's coming not from the sky, but from the ground.
You know, I wanted to expound on that, because ground reflected light is a very beautiful light, I think. And
sure.
One of the things, and here I am in talking about Japanese, traditional Japanese houses, is that a lot of that light is ground reflected light.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have the outdoor, usually when you have the indoor, you have the tatami mat, and then it steps out into a veranda, the light hits the eave, and then that you're getting the indirect light from that. That it hits the ground, then it hits the eave, and then goes inside. It's
exactly.
Very beautiful.
Exactly. And the other thing that's really nice about Japanese, but in other places in Asia as well, but in Japan, they very early on got the sort of the beauty of shadows and of darkness, and the idea that you only needed to have a small amount of light to really have a profound effect. So there's a sacred quality to light that is kind of, again, embodied in a lot of the traditional architecture, from the shoji screens right on through the ground reflected light and that sort of stuff. So you don't really see a lot of these sort of really brightly lit spaces in Japan in the way that you do in a lot of the places in the United States. Now, in North Carolina, if you were going to have a clear story, and there actually are some really good examples, I don't know if you're familiar with the Mount Airy Library in North Carolina, but you can have...
How do you spell that?
A-I-R-Y. It's a building that was done, probably early 80s, by an architect named Ed Mazaria, who's now in New Mexico. And it's a really nice little passive solar library done in North Carolina, which has a very, very, very low energy use, about one-fifth of a typical library built at the same time. And it's mostly through daylighting. And it has some north-facing clear stories, but it has quite a few south-facing clear stories. And as the light is brought in from above on the south, it's shaded, and they have these little kind of baffles underneath the clear stories that become a surface which is illuminated by these clear story, by the direct light coming into the clear stories, and then allows it to be diffused so that you can have a nice even daylight inside the space while still taking advantage of the passive solar heat gain, which is so important in that area of North Carolina in the wintertime. And so the building really works nicely because it can take advantage of both the sunny days and also cloudy days, which you get quite a few of. And then it also is able to...
How do you know that?
The light and the heat
you
gain.
Live in North Carolina. How do you know we have a lot of cloudy days?
we do projects all over, and I did live in Asheville, North Carolina, for a couple years back in the mid '70s. And
yeah, but isn't Asheville always in the clouds anyway? That's a joke.
It gets it's a nice climate.
I don't know anything about Asheville as far as the cloudiness. Is it cloudy or not?
It's a mixed climate. It's kind of a certain amount of sun and cloudy conditions, and then also quite cool winters can have, and sometimes it gets hot in the summer, but not terribly hot. It's a pretty pleasant climate.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually sort of a resort place for a while.
You know what I have noticed about what you were talking about so far is that you're very aware of the weather and the climate.
Yeah.
In other words, I noticed when people learn something, they often might repeat something that somebody else said, but I'm noticing that you're very observant. You're not just repeating what someone told you. You're actually synthesizing and thinking about what you're talking about. I know that, what am I saying? I know that sounds really, I'm not... it's very thoughtful, and we need more people like that.
Well,
and maybe that's why you're at the Rocky Mountain Institute.
I don't know, but I do have fun with it. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And climate is, as you sort of started out this conversation when you were mentioning that, you know, we all exist every day in daylight, but we don't oftentimes really think about it. I do find it quite exciting to kind of ponder the world around us. And
yeah, so let's go back to the clear story in Asheville, or what you said. So you said that clear story in a south-facing, that was in Mount
Mary Library.
Yeah, and that was south-facing clear stories, and that was okay. That was great, right?
Yes.
And it sounds like it could exist in all except the west. Is that correct?
I think what happens is as you move from climate to climate, you need to adjust your designs for the requirements of the building and the requirements of the program, as well as the attributes of the climate. So we did a project in Las Vegas, which had some south-facing windows, but had quite a bit more north-facing windows because, of course, they are really in cooling mode almost all year round. But even in the north-facing windows, we didn't make them very large because there's a lot of light.
In Las Vegas. So would you have clear story windows in Las Vegas facing north?
You certainly could.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it depends on the kind of building that you're designing and mm-hmm. the needs that you have. So with certain kinds of buildings can take better advantage of the different sorts of daylighting attributes. And I think maybe a way to think about this is light actually is a way of forming your building design. So you can bring in light from the side, from windows. You can bring in light from up top through skylights or some kind of clear stories. Or you can bring in light through some kind of shared central courtyard or atrium or, you know, light wells or something like that. So all of those things actually can profoundly affect the form of the building. And, of course, ideally, the form of the building supports the different program needs you have. If it's a classroom or an office or a library or something, you're going to have different ways of organizing the spaces in the building, and then the light should reinforce your way you move through that space. I could give an example of that, which
so,
is...
let's repeat what you just said.
Sure.
Light only comes from the side or the top, pretty much. Right, it only goes from the side, and it's either indirect or direct. And I think the better way is the indirect.
Well, I think that there are always different there's reasons to use it in different manners. And I think if we can sort of set a certain kind of rules of thumb, and then as you become more capable as a designer, you're allowed to sort of stretch those rules or adjust them for the given situation. And I think that's where something like LEED comes in well.
Mm-hmm.
The Leadership in an Energy and Environmental Design program that the U.S. Green Building Council has put together has some very basic ideas in there about daylighting, that you should have a glazing factor of about 2% that says, so if you have 100 I'd say 1,000-foot candles outside your window, then you have 20-foot candles on your desktop. So it's about 2% of the exterior light on your desktop. And that's good, and that's a good criteria
in
general.
What did you say? You said 20-foot candles?
Yeah, so there's a certain percentage of light on inside the building as opposed to being outside.
Mm-hmm.
and the good thing is that it's a basic idea that anybody can do anywhere. But, of course, because of that, it's not. It needs to be really carefully thought of when you're trying to apply it, because there's times when that might be too much light or not enough light, depending on if you're designing in Anchorage or in Las Vegas, or the different kinds of buildings that you're working on. I worked on a school here in Colorado that is, I think, a beautifully daylit project. Everybody's very happy with it. But it doesn't meet the criteria of the LEED rating system because it actually doesn't have enough window area to, you know, by their criteria, to actually provide enough daylight. But if you're in the space, you actually see that it's just fine. You can turn off the electric lights, and it works just fine. Now, that criteria in other cases works very well, in that there's other places that are designed to meet the lead criteria for daylight and are very nicely daylit spaces. So the criteria is just that. It doesn't substitute for actually design. It's just a simple kind of rule of thumb that helps you get close to where you need to be.
Mm-hmm. So you want to talk about an example, or you want to go on a break? Why don't we go on a break?
As you wish.
We're here with Victor Olgay, and he's from the Rocky Mountain Institute. He's a principal there, and he's on the built environment team. I am Emmy Louie. You're listening to the Emmy Louie Show. The Rocky Mountain Institute's website is rmi.org, and we'll be back. Welcome back. I am Emmy Louie, and we're talking about daylighting. We're here with Victor Olgay, and he's from the Rocky Mountain Institute built environment team. He's a principal there. And we were talking about, we're talking about all these different ways of lighting. And the classical example of lighting I see as a archetype is the Gothic cathedral. And the lighting developed during that time is just truly inspiring. Now, I was thinking I would love to use that same type of light now, but a lot of it is, well, let's break it down with the Gothic cathedral, and I'll take a stab at it, and then Victor will make some comments. But the Gothic cathedral, the basis of it is the flying buttress, and the buttress extends so far, it's like a arch, and then you have these repeated flying buttresses, just repeated, and between those flying buttresses are windows. But by the time the light hits the windows, it's actually kind of indirect light by the time it hits it, because it's hitting it from, it hits the flying buttress, and then the light goes to, from the flying buttress to the window. And so it creates this very ethereal light. The issue here is, with the type of materials that we use where I live, is that we can't use that many flying buttresses here. How do we translate the Gothic cathedral paradigm with their natural, very heavenly light to our modern day living? And all, how do we translate those types of materials? Because we don't all have flying buttresses and masonry and a whole bunch of masons working with us and all that. So
sure.
What are your thoughts about that, Victor?
Well, yeah, it's it is a very exciting idea, and you're absolutely right that Gothic in particular, Gothic is kind of the highest aspiration of sort of a Mason's art form, and became a what was really in many ways a struggle between the wall and the window. And it was born, you know, in kind of the Central European countries, to a large degree because of the climate that they had there, or that they do have there, which, you know, is a lot of overcast skies. And they were always trying to, you know, take the spiritual side of light, you know, light and spirit being so closely intertwined in both the sort of the meaning of the word as well as kind of the experiences. So the religious experience became this idea of trying to actually optimize or really increase the amount of light that you could have in those buildings. And so they tried to make the windows larger and larger and larger, and the columns narrower and narrower, and then, you know, stilled in order to be able to hold the roof onto those skinny little bits of wall that were left. They ended up creating these buttresses, which then were not solid walls, but again became these columnar kind of systems, which were able to kind of take the forces and spread them and bring them down to the ground. And so all of this, as you say, kind of really results in large windows and kind of a a netting of structure that light kind of trickles through to get to the interior of the space. So there's some really exciting stuff that's going on there. One thing is that we've got overcast skies, so you need larger amounts of glass to get the light in there. You don't see any Gothic cathedrals in Sicily or, you know, in Greece. You know, they had small windows there because they had a sunny climate. But you have up in these northern climates, you do have these overcast skies and you have large windows. And then the windows themselves were never undecorated. Because if you look at that cold northern sky, it's not inspiring. It's sort of gloomy or dank or something. And so what ended up happening was these windows became areas where they became embellished with colored glass and with paintings and so forth. And so the light itself becomes colored. It becomes, through these stained glass windows, you're enriching the luminous quality of the light. The visual information in there becomes this, you know, amazing color and pattern. And you love to look at, you know, all of these, not only because it's beautiful craftsmanship, but it's because it's empowering the light with all of this different color and visual information. So what happened in these Gothic cathedrals is they took something which was kind of a liability, sort of the darkness of the climate. They opened it up to these large amounts of glass, and then they ended up coloring that light, so the light that comes in is now, you know, basically inspired. So it's a really neat thing, and I think if you go to lots of these places in France or England, you'll see instead of having gray light in these buildings, you'll have red and yellow and kind of orange and warm colored light instead of that cool, cold overcast colors, and that makes you feel quite excited. And it's hard to kind of translate those things to other climates. There are, you know, cathedrals in New York City, and, you know, we could do one in North Carolina or something, but they'll probably end up feeling a little bit out of place. We definitely can make glass boxes, like, you know, now that we have steel architecture, that we can, you know, basically eliminate the necessity for masonry in our buildings. We can have much greater spans and actually have buildings which are like greenhouses, essentially completely glass. But then there's liabilities associated with that. There was another seminal building that happened in Europe was the Crystal Pavilion in England in the 1850s, I believe. And what happened there was that was one of these, around the time of the Eiffel Tower and the sort of understanding of how steel structure can really become an intrinsic part of the architecture. It allowed, again, more and more glass to happen, and then we started to understand the influence of solar radiation for on the insides of buildings. And, you know, we kind of go back and forth now where we can have too much glass for buildings and too little glass and basically play this whole game between the structure and the opening.
Mm-hmm. Let me use an example. A very mundane example. One of my friends or neighbors, she had screened in porch and her roof was not doing very well, so she replaced it with a corrugated plastic roof. And then I guess she didn't consult me, but after that she said, "Oh my God, it's so hot."
Mm-hmm.
That same clear roof could probably do quite well in Vermont. Is that correct?
Well, it
up
could.
Up north.
It could. And
but here, it's just way too much sun.
That's right. So
it's way too much sun. Let's take, for example, a greenhouse. The same greenhouse cannot necessarily exist in Hawaii. You cannot. It's just too much
sun. Exactly.
I mean, that's really extreme, but let's move up and down the latitude. Let's go from Florida. I cannot.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. We need to basically adjust the orientation and kind of glass and amount of glass depending on what you're trying to do
and
where you're located.
Well, this was actually a roof. This was actually a roof, though. It was a clear roof. You can't do that.
And so, mm-hmm. the other thing that's interesting, of course, is the sun, you know, in the wintertime is lower and comes more, the light comes in more horizontally. And in the summertime, the sun is more vertical and comes in, you know, more from the roof. So if you do something where you have a lot of glass on a roof, especially in a house, this is a terrible idea because usually in the summertime you're already warm and you're letting more light in through the skylights, right? Being in Hawaii, this is a typical problem, is that, you know, people would love skylights and then put in these skylights.
How could you put a skylight in Hawaii? I'm sorry. I mean, can you? I mean,
well,
really?
Well, people do it all the time in these
high-end
houses, and they
Why?
Pay a big price, you know.
Why? Because I know this. I actually have a skylight in my house, but I think some skylights, there are either two types of skylights, and I don't know if this is true. Maybe you have some reaction to this. There are either skylights that haven't leaked yet, and there are skylights that are already leaking. And you're laughing.
It's a little bit cynical, but...
I must have hit something about that. And especially if they exist in Hawaii, you know,
yeah.
I mean, the gaskets are going to evaporate in a few years.
Well, there's definitely issues of roof leakage, but, you know, we actually do some pretty crazy stuff with roofs. So I think that if you have somebody who is a good builder and they can typically overcome that, I mean, he can drive a car at whatever it is, 60 miles an hour down the highway, and it's got a skylight in it or a roof light, you know, and it doesn't leak, so you ought to be able to do it on a house. But oftentimes that's, as you said, not the case. So leaking is a problem, and then the heat gain is a real problem. And so, you know, there's places where a skylight can work really well, but they have to be done really carefully. And so we definitely kind of go back and forth on that, and you know, try and get light into the middle of a building, which is a, you know, in a place where, you know, you have no opportunity of having windows. Then sometimes using a small amount of well-placed skylight can be exactly the right thing to do.
When would it be a disaster? Have you ever seen something like that?
Oh, often.
Tell me about it. Tell me.
Unfortunately, there's many more sort of examples of
because
bad daylighting
than good
daylighting.
Because we're trying to talk about the bad example of the badly placed skylight, so our listeners won't do the same thing.
Yeah.
Tell me an example.
The main thing is to, again, integrate it with the overall problem, the overall, you know, building. If it's a, I guess maybe a typical thing might be a, if you have a house and you have a living room and you're in a place maybe like North Carolina, or it could be Florida, or, you know, a hotter climate, and you've got a large amount of skylights, you know, that are over a living room or something, then a lot of times you'll just get too much light in the summertime. And the sad part is that usually you won't get as much light in the wintertime when you would probably welcome the direct light. So the way that people usually deal with that is by giving that glass a tint, or basically playing with the light transmission. So, you know, basically giving it putting sunglasses on it. So you've got a lower amount of light that actually gets transferred through the glass. That just really kind of compounds the problem because you may not get as much light, you know, in the summertime, but you get even less in the wintertime, and then you've still got all of that glass, which is essentially a hole in your building that lets, you know, heat in or cools out or whatever when you don't want it. So we very rarely find that you can have a large amount of skylights and not have a big problem.
Mm-hmm. And also, I was there. We didn't talk about the psychological. We did talk about the psychological part of daylighting, and that when you have, we talk about having a lot of windows and having it open. There is a negative effect to having too much light, and it manifests as a behavior called mania, mm-hmm. just being overly stimulated, and of course. The lack of light is result in depression or SAD.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the seasonal affective disorder. So, it's really interesting, actually, that light can be, you can imagine light almost as a drug or food, you know, and just like you
I never thought of it as a drug, but yes.
it does affect the chemicals in, you know, melatonin and other mm-hmm. chemicals that you have, and just like you should only eat when you're hungry, you really need light at specific times as well, and there's some really interesting studies that are going on right now. I think the seasonal affective disorder stuff is pretty clear.
Yeah, it's talked about a lot. It's more like the mania we haven't talked about. Maybe we should have mania studies. No, you hear about it, SAD, you hear about it all the time. I heard it on the radio this morning, and it seemed like it was regular news. So maybe we should talk about mania. In other words, and this has to do with, and we only have a few more minutes, but a lot of crimes happen in springtime is because there's more light and maybe it's better outside, so people go outside. And there's, like you call it, was it in Camelot where the story is where they come out in spring and there's a lot of festival-making, love-making and all that. And so it's manic. So in other words, that behavior, it's imbalance. So imbalance in the winter is depression, and imbalance in the summer is mania.
Yeah.
And I think we should talk more about, we should study more about mania. Any thoughts about that?
Well, in Seville, Spain, they basically blame the orange blossoms for that it's the scent of the oranges blooming that causes people to fall in love and to do all of these irrational things. I'm not convinced that mania is such a terrible thing.
Oh, you're not convinced? Mm-hmm.
No, I think oftentimes it's really, you know, we spend so much of our lives inside buildings these days. If we went outside, you just go out. The best thing for any of your listeners listening to this program today, at your lunch break, go outside for an hour and walk around, even half an hour, 20 minutes. If you can go outside and let that sunlight come into your eyes and be absorbed by your skin, even if it's a cold, rainy day or drizzly, it really will help with all of your different sort of chemical balances
in
your body.
Yes, I think you're addressing that because we are in office environments. But if you're a regular worker in Greece, you're probably staying away from the sun. So it all depends, and it goes back to what you said. It depends.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Victor O.J., for being on my show.
It's a pleasure.
And his website is the Rocky Mountain Institute, and that's www.rmi.org. It was a great show. We talked about daylighting. I hope we made some kind of complicated topics or very mundane topics and had that entertain you. I'm Emmy Louie with the Emmy Louie Show, and have a great week. See you next time. Bye-bye.